Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Heidi Moore, and for Brian Lehrer, we talked about money in the economy with the fiscal cliff and Nelson Schwartz earlier in the cast, but how about the money in our pockets and the money we see changing hands around us? There's something about working with dollars that influences us. I have a friend, Jacob Harris, who refuses to distinguish among the various people who work in finance. He calls them all money workers. My next guest, Kevin J. Delaney, takes that concept big. He's a professor of sociology at Temple University, and he has a new book, Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. Thanks for being with us, Kevin.
You're welcome, Heidi. It's a pleasure.
So right at the top, I want to ask for calls. Listeners, do you think money has changed your personality? Call in 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can comment on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer. So, Kevin, tell me, what do priests, poker players, and hedge fund traders have in common? And don't tell me they all walked into a bar.
Yeah, they all walked into a bar. Well, I do have a bartender's joke that I could tell you later, but what they all have in common is that money is a central feature of their day-to-day work life, and I'm convinced that the way they handle money and deal with money in their job has a great influence on how they think about money, and I mean that both the way they think about it at work, but also how it extends into their personal life. So I'm trying to make the argument that the way we deal with money in our jobs really shapes us just as much as more commonly thought things like our childhood experiences, our money personalities. One thing we haven't paid a lot of attention to is how we use money at work and how that changes us. And I know in my own life, all the different jobs I've had have really influenced the way I end up thinking about money, not just at work, but also outside of work.
So to contradict my friend, there's no such thing as money workers, at least within one industry. We're all money workers.
I think we're all money workers in one way or another. Now, in the book, I do choose about 10 occupations in which money is quite central, and I do admit there's other occupations where it's a bit less central. But everyone deals with money in one way or another and are paid in particular ways. And I found, too, that the way you get paid can have a big influence. I'm sure many of your listeners have experience working as bartenders or wait staff. I myself was a bartender for a while, and it's very common knowledge that when you work as a bartender or a waiter or waitress, you often have a lot of cash burning a hole in your pocket, and it really makes a difference to the way you think about money, the way you spend money, the type of people you hang around with, the way you tip other people, other fellow bartenders or wait staff, and that's just one of many examples of how money affects you. I also worked as a toll collector for a while, and certainly being around cash in toll booths and in that little building on the side of the highway had a big influence in the way I thought about money. And now I'm an academic and work as a vice dean building budgets in universities. I have a totally different way of thinking about money. It's much more abstract. It's at a larger scale, but it has affected the way I think about money. For example, when you're a bartender, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about your 401k investments. You often don't have them, and so thinking about that is painful. But when you're an academic, you think about that a lot. So there's many ways in which the way money influences us at work has a bigger influence.
I want to open it up to listeners again. We're at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Tell us about how money has influenced how you think about the world. So, Kevin, in your book, you cite a study by Mitch Abulafia about bond traders, that their personalities are eventually shaped by their job function. So they're not just bond traders at work, but also when they go home. Their job involves following the rules of money in the office, and then they go home, and in the emotional realm, they're still following the rules of money. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'll give you a good example from a hedge fund trader that I happen to study. A couple of things about the money cultures that hedge fund traders are in. They are often thinking about risk and reward, obviously, and they're often thinking about taking bets, making gambles, making difficult high-pressure decisions without complete information. They may have a lot of information, but not complete information. So they're constantly weighing this up, and many of them are trained in game theory and things like that. So they have a certain way of talking, and I was out at after years talking to a hedge fund trader and watching him work, we were out at a kind of a lunch truck in New York City, and he was purchasing a sandwich. And I said to him, now, how do you think about this purchase? And he said, well, the sandwich here is going to cost me about $7. And I said, that's a lot. Is it worth it? And he said, no, it's not particularly a good sandwich, but I'm going to buy it because it's convenient. And to me, I thought I would stand there and grouse about paying an overprice for a sandwich. But he said something differently. He said, I am online and I am buying it, so it must be worth it to me. So therefore, the convenience premium outweighs the value problem here. And I could just walk away, but I'm going to pull the trigger and buy the sandwich. Now, that language, walk away, pull the trigger, is exactly the language he uses at work. And I think most people do not think about convenience premiums and trade-off costs when they're waiting at a lunch truck to buy a sandwich. But he did, and that affected the way he thought about things. And I think that's true for a lot of people that get into the financial industry. They're trained in a very specific kind of disciplined way of thinking about the world, and they think about that. They are very aware of price, but price isn't the only thing they're thinking about, just like the way they make trades.
Well, let's talk to Joseph from Suffolk, New York. He's a personal banker, and he has some views on this. Joseph?
Yes, I would like to say more so for bankers who look at transactions that customers have every day, dealing with very tight customers, ones who are, you know, affluent and ones who are not. The ones who are affluent are way more in control of the monies that they have and use, and the ones who are not just accept, you know, whatever they can get or whatever the bank has to charge them for buying a sandwich that costs them $35 when the sandwich is only $5.
Yeah, I think you're right. I have a chapter that compares investment advisors with debt counselors, which gets to the same issue you're talking about. The investment advisors are tending to advise, obviously, high net worth individuals and giving the kind of advice about how to deal with their money, and they talk a certain way. For example, they don't really get into their individual clients' personal problems too much. When you turn around and go to the bankruptcy debt counselor's office, they're asking their clients to keep a daily diary of every penny they spend, and they use a much more psychological framework in talking about the kind of problem areas they get in, the spending areas they get in. So here's two jobs in which you're advising people on how to use money or how to spend their money, and it's an entirely different set of vocabulary, approach, and language to it. And I think bankers are a good example because bankers see transactions going in many directions. They think about bank fees and all of that, and they get a real sense of other people's money, just like as investment advisors and bankruptcy counselors do. They're very much into the mess, if you will, of other people's money.
And another caller on how money can stretch into all parts of our lives is Dan from Bridgewater. Dan, are you there?
Hi. I'm from the 60s generation, so to me money never meant anything. But I find it very interesting how my kids see it. One is a stockbroker, one is a professional, one is a scientist, and one is a physician. And the stockbroker seems to feel this necessity to reward himself and his family with constant expenditures. The professional is really more interested in how the money assists him in rising in his own profession. The healthcare workers is really wishing he wasn't making this money and could have time to do other things. And the scientist one is just absolutely disinterested in money and is heading down a road of terrible problem from disregard rather than management. And I wondered if the gentleman sees this kind of distinction in these four categories of people.
Kevin, what have you seen?
Dan, I see that a lot, and what's funny is they all came from the same family, so such different stories. I come from a family of five children, and we all have different relationships to money in that same way. So, yes, I do see that all the time. I studied a lot of commission salespeople who are constantly under the gun to sell, and a lot of them reward themselves in the same way. I had a great conversation with a salesman who talked about quitting a job and how difficult that was, and when he quit the job and he had no future prospects at that moment, he rewarded himself with a $2,000 watch. To me, I would never think of rewarding myself by buying something expensive when I had just lost my income. But to him, it was all about showing faith in himself and confidence. he later in the interview talked about wearing the perfect suit, and he bought a $900 suit so that he could feel that there was not a single problem with that suit. And one of the most interesting things he said to me is, it's not showing off to others, it's showing off to yourself, because if you have the confidence in yourself, others will feel that confidence and buy from you. These are very different ways of thinking about money.
Can I bring in just one last point?
Sure, Dan.
In my case, my generation, you know, we all had this assured minimum old age pension. And we really didn't care. We figured, you know, we lived on principles. The 60s trained us that way. We survived through Vietnam and everything. So, you know, we do all right. In their cases, in all their cases, they have absolutely no future ahead. And they're so today-oriented. All of them have children. And they have absolutely no perspective about outrageously unbearable expenses like college for their kids, helping their kids get a house someday, or what they're going to do with their old age. And this is scaring me more than anything else.
Isn't that interesting? It's almost like the disappearance of security has led people to almost give up on the idea of planning, and I see that with a lot of people. Because something feels sort of hopeless, like college tuition always often feels this way, people will say, it's so hopeless, I prefer not to start. Now, that's not the best thing to do, but lots of people end up feeling that way. I'll live for the moment. And I think we do have a culture now in which a lot of people feel the lack of security leads to a feeling of hopelessness, leads to lack of planning, leads to live for the moment. And it is a little frightening, isn't it, thinking about that as what's coming in the future. Speaking about the 60s mentality, I also studied people who are experimenting with money in their work, and so I spent a lot of time up in Ithaca, New York, participating in their Ithaca Hours alternative currency program. And there you have a lot of 60s generation people, but also they're pairing up with some young people like the kind Dan are talking about and playing around with money. They're saying, if money is not working for us in this economy, we'll create different ways of using money. So there's also the other side to the younger generation today is they're doing some amazing experiments with things like free cycling and freeganism and all kinds of things like that. Out in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, there was a free store there for a while where people could come and exchange goods. So there are some really interesting experiments that come out of this sort of lack of security and predictability in life, too, and I don't want to miss that.
Well, Kevin,
how will this translate in our relationship with, let's say, the Chinese in the next 30 or 40 years, or the Europeans or other countries, when we as a nation are sort of following these hell with the future perspectives?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we're in some danger of being outcompeted and becoming an economy that just spends for the moment. I shudder to really think about that. My hope is that we continue to be innovative enough and creative enough in a society that we keep ahead of the game, but I do have some worries in that regard.
Thank you, Dan, for those questions. And picking up on some of Dan's concerns, Kevin, one of your interesting themes is that people who work with money, which is all of us, struggle to stay rational about it. I mean, even traders who win or lose on instinct, that's really a set of emotions. So does
that's
money
right.
make us crazy or at least irrational? Is it addictive?
You know, I think in a lot of jobs there's this quest to tame emotion, but I think it's a really insoluble, unsolvable dilemma. Emotion has always been part of money and always will be. So when you look at a hedge fund trader or a poker player, another group I studied, they spend a lot of time trying to tame their emotions, yet they turn around and then talk about how they use emotion in their job. So the poker player has to be able to read the emotion of another player. A poker player has to disguise his or her own emotion. So emotion comes into all money transactions. I think the key is understanding your emotions and trying to use it to your advantage. The quantitative hedge fund traders, those are the people that try to do things strictly on quantitative modeling, they try to model emotion. So they also don't truly remove emotion from the equation. They try to predict mass emotion. And so I think this quest for kind of disciplining our emotions is actually fruitless. The better way to go is to understand how your emotion does connect to money, and by understanding it, incorporating it into your decision making. Because everyone, you know, who's bought a car knows that emotion comes into the process. I think it's hopeless to say that you're going to discipline and remove your emotion. Instead, you want to understand how the emotion is affecting the negotiation.
Let's hear from Alexis in Red Bank, New Jersey on that. Alexis, what do you have to say?
Hi. So I grew up without money, and I'm now married to somebody who makes, you know, a good amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things that I've noticed, and it dovetails on some of your other callers, is that, for example, when I had no money, if I bounced a check at a bank,
right.
God helped me trying to get that bounced check be reversed. Now that we have a big account, if I walk in and just say something happens, there's no problem. Everybody wants to make the person with the money happy.
You're treated differently as a high net worth investor, huh?
Yeah. And then
it is,
something
yeah.
else I also wanted to comment on, the person at the food truck
mm-hmm.
saying, okay, so it's convenient for me.
Right.
You know, even as a mom now, I find that I do that all the time. I say, okay, so this is convenient. I can do this. But other people in my family couldn't afford to make that decision.
That's
but
right.
generally, once somebody is capable of making that decision, whether they're a bond trader or a stay-at-home mom, people will often spend for convenience.
You're making a very good point, Alexis, and that is we're all not in the same structural situation. You know, it's nice to say our time should be equal a certain amount of money, and so we choose convenience over time. But if you're poor or you have no
yeah.
money, you're facing a different set of decisions, aren't you? I mean,
yeah.
if you're not earning any money, in effect, the society is saying your time is worthless.
Mm-hmm.
So going way out of your way to save 10 cents, in fact, could be the logical thing to do. So you're making a very good observation about how your own life has changed, and now you've been given the sort of comfort level to value your time at a certain amount that you might not have had at other times in your life.
And I'd like to say then, the emotional part becomes so intense for the person who feels they don't have the leeway or the freedom mm-hmm. that the person, once you build up a little bit of money,
mm-hmm.
everything starts to get easier and no one's pinning you to the wall for a mistake. When you have no money and you bounce a check and mm-hmm. then it causes several other checks to bounce, you will be emotional.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It,
yes.
it, it's all related.
Yes, I'm really thinking a lot about the bankruptcy and debt counselors I spent time with, and people would come into their office with a bag full of receipts and bills, and they'd be in tears, and you could tell that their comfort level, their ability to make any errors was so tiny, anything would push them over the edge, and that really got in the way of them making any kinds of decisions. And then they're asked to fill out these budget diaries in which they're counting every single penny, and that even, you know, it's understandable, but it heightens the pressure on them. And then when the counselor would see that they spent a dollar on a cup of coffee, they'd say, ah, that's a problem area, you have to cut out that spending. So they're having their lives investigated and questioned at a level that a wealthier person would never have it questioned. They would buy maybe a Starbucks coffee for $5 and say that they're choosing it based on its convenience to them, and nobody is subjecting them to the same interrogation that the person who is at the debt counselor's office is being subjected to.
And Kevin, that goes to the point you made in your book about money and fairness, and we have a caller, Max in Westchester, who has some thoughts about that. Max, are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. Tell us your story.
So I'm 25 now, and I've grown up for about half of my life without money, and now we have more money. But over the course of my life, I've, you know, tried to plan to have money for my children and, like, to be able to pay for their college. And I've just found that all of those plans have kind of locked me down in, like, you know, this area of unhappiness, seeking something that I find to be kind of not even wanted at this point.
Mm. So you're on kind of are you on an endless quest for security for the kids? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on this, you know, this course for security for my children that I don't have
mm-hmm.
because I didn't feel that at my childhood, and it hasn't brought me any security.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's almost as if we pivot from our family of origin to our new family, trying to solve the problems of the family of origin for our children, and it doesn't always necessarily help us very much, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it is interesting. I grew up without a lot of money, Dan, and the way it was handled in my family, I felt, was that our desires were tamped down a lot. Like, you don't really want that chocolate bar. It really won't taste that good. And I absorbed that and embraced it. So I'm one of those people that has a really hard time spending money on anything or having any hobbies or anything like that. And I've struggled with that for a long time. And it has this positive element to it, and that I tend to be quite happy with very little. But when I look at other people or my own children who I've given more to, they seem to be able to enjoy spending money a little bit easier than I did. So I'm kind of, you still have that kind of burden around your neck probably for a good portion of your life.
Yeah, and I'm Heidi Moore. I'm in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm talking to Kevin J. Delaney. He wrote a book called Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. And one of the things that you've just hit upon, Kevin, and our last caller talked about as well, was in your book, you mentioned that money has often been seen as a barrier to spiritual growth or to the growth of a society. And in fact, until just recently, there was no difference made between finance, gambling, and speculation. And in your chapter on the clergy, you talk about how they don't even see money as a factor in their lives because they feel that helps them to grow. Do you see that at work with other people as well?
I do on occasion, and it's interesting. I actually talked to a bond trader once who was this sort of person, and that's very unusual among bond traders. And he said that he was more of an ascetic person. He didn't really like a lot of money. And he talked about how it drove his managers crazy because they would prefer the sword of Damocles over his head with a big mortgage and a nice second home out on Long Island or something like that. And he was happy being a mid-range earner, and it really drove his bosses crazy because he didn't fit there. But in other jobs, it works fine. I did run into one gentleman who had been a commissioned salesperson, and due to a kind of religious conversion, he was actually operating under the logic of trying to take smaller and smaller salaries in his life. Very deliberately, he would try to take a $20,000 salary decrease because he wanted to see what it was like to give up possessions. Now, he did a lot of these reverse mission trips to Africa and other places and saw people with a lot less, and he had such a different conception of money. He said to me, think about how much you read about $1 or $2 million not being enough to retire on. And I said, yes, I read that all the time. And he said, I spend time in other countries that don't even have a conception of retirement. People are just cared for by their community. And it was really an enlightening thing to think about, that we've managed to scare ourselves and make ourselves feel so insecure because we're afraid to count on other people, that we think we need $2 or $3 million to retire. That is ludicrous in many parts of the world.
How interesting. Let's talk to Mike from Queens. He wants some practical tips that we can take on how we can think about money. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. And I wanted to thank Kevin for doing this research. And I was wondering, now that it exists, if it's possible or more research needs to be done into the reverse effect. In other words, adopting someone's psychology in order to change the way that you deal with money, or to change your psychology, I guess. And both ways, too. I mean, it could be adopting a clergyman's psychology in order to become more spiritual in your view of worldly possessions, or maybe a banker's psychology in order to increase your net worth, et cetera.
Yes, Mike, I think that's a good point. I think the way I think about it as a sociologist rather than a psychologist is simply that you want to try the best you can to sort of align the structural requirements of your job with the way you want to think about and deal with money. And very few people think about that when they're taking a job. It's not just that you have to have the right personality to be a hedge fund trader or a banker or a salesperson. Those jobs will change who you are. They really will affect who you are if you do them for 20, 30, or 40 years. So if you think about the way money is used in particular lines of work, in some ways that is who you'll become if you stay in that line of work, at least to a certain degree. So one little piece of advice I'd have is, if you have a clear vision, or if anyone has a clear vision of the type of person they'd like to be in relation to money, and I'm just not talking only about how much you're going to earn, which lots of people think about, but how you'll earn that money and how you'll get paid that money and what that will make you, and align that with your values. For example, I interviewed a lot of grant givers, people who are grant officers that make grants, and many of them were quite happy in their work because they spent a lot of time making a difference in people's lives and going to community groups where they've made grants, and they were able to gain a certain appreciation for certain things in lives in their lives, and they seemed quite happy. On the other hand, fundraisers are often in the homes of people much wealthier than them, and that can feel very seductive and sometimes very discouraging, because when you're sitting in someone's home that has 10 times as much wealth as you are, it's very easy to feel, I could be them, even though you never did what they did to earn that money, whether mm-hmm. that is work or being born into it. But it's very seductive, and if you don't come to grips with that, it can really burn you out and make you feel quite depressed, or lead you to do things that are unethical or illegal to try to get there. So if you're going to be a fundraiser, you really have to learn how to come to grips with traveling in the world of other people that have a lot more than you. And those kind of dilemmas of seduction can be very difficult. So you really have to think a lot about the type of career you're taking and how that is going to shape the way you deal with money throughout your life, not simply how much you're going to earn.
Yeah, and we hear from somebody on our website who said he used to be a bartender, but now that he owns his own business and is responsible for every dollar in and out, it's a whole other story. Thank you so much, Kevin.
You're very welcome, Heidi. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. My guest was Kevin J. Delaney. He wrote a book called Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. And up next, we are going to talk about the Orthodox Jewish community and the Internet.